A huge storm front was coming in, and his producer wanted him to cover that instead. With the deal made, we could exhale and get a well-needed night's rest. John and I were up early the following day to scout the property, only to find out the reporter and his crew had already been out there and filed a story at dawn from the front of the FLDS compound. It would air that night, and his presence had tipped off the FLDS that their secret compound had been found. I was ready to chew nails at being double-crossed, and Krakauer telephoned the reporter to verbally whip his butt for lying to us. Unwilling to let him enjoy his exclusive, I called El Dorado Success editor Randy Mankin, down in Texas, who also had been brought into the loop about the Moncos development with the understanding that he would not publish anything until I checked it out. Now, I gave him the green light to post the news on his website, www.myeldorado.net, and he scooped the TV show by hours. John and I headed to the compound for some daytime surveillance. The only way to get a look at the property without being noticed was to skirt around about a mile to the north and go in through the woods. It had been quite a while since I had done any hiking, and I had a tough time trying to keep up with John. But I kept reminding myself, he'd climbed Mount Everest. When we finally reached a vantage point where I could catch my breath, I said, "Okay, John, if anything happens, I've got my .22 pocket pistol and a .45 Colt with me. I'm going to toss you the .22 and you run for help, and I'll stay here and shoot it out." I was only half kidding. The truth was that Krakauer could have been out of the woods and back with a posse and a cup of coffee before I had made it halfway back to the car. We were able to get the lay of the land without being noticed. We spotted several parked vehicles around the area, but they were too far away to get their plate numbers. The fences were down around most of the heavily wooded property, and it was hard to tell where National Forest started and the compound property began. We decided to return that night to see if we could get a little closer, then went back to town and enjoyed a pleasant dinner at a little restaurant that featured a big sign, "Welcome Deer Hunters." The season had begun in Colorado. We returned to the forest when it was pitch black. Earlier in the day, we had heard generators purring in the distance and the coughing of a tractor, but it was dead silent now. There were no lights burning anywhere. Apparently, the news had gotten back to them about the discovery, and a total blackout had been imposed. John was clearly in his outdoorsy element, clipping along in the darkness almost as if he knew the GPS location of each tree. He was my navigator, so I stayed close enough to make out his shape and listen to his footsteps in the darkness. I was counting on him to get us close to some of those cars so that we could get a visual on the license plates in the hope that they might lead us to Jeff's. Suddenly, I heard the crunch of someone else's footsteps coming from the opposite direction. I switched off my night vision goggles to prevent anyone from spotting their faint glow. John was about 10 feet ahead, too far for me to call out a warning without giving up our location. The newcomer was within about 4 feet of me when he realized he was not alone. He snapped on his flashlight, shining it directly in my face. So I turned on my flashlight and put it directly in his face.
"Whoa! Who are you?"
he asked, totally surprised.
"Think fast, Brower."
All the talk about the violent history of radical fundamentalists came flooding back to me. John was far enough ahead that he hadn't even heard the guy until he spoke. Ignoring my earlier advice of going to get help, John returned to back me up. The best defense is always a good offense.
"Who are you?
What are you doing out here?" I snapped back at the guard with whom I was having the flashlight duel.
"Take that light out of my face," he said.
"Okay, take yours out of mine," I commanded back, unwilling to give up any ground.
"This is our property."
He was a big dude, at least my size, a little heavier, and at least 20 years younger. His comment confirmed he was an FLDS guard. I needed to keep him talking, so I protested. "No, it's not. This is National Forest Service land." A little unsure by now, He admitted that the fences were down in some areas and that maybe we had stumbled through one of those gaps. His tone changed.
Why are you here?
For some reason, the welcome sign from that little restaurant blinked in my mind. We're deer hunters, I responded. I saw John's jaw drop when I said it. The guard looked us over.
Well, how come you don't have any rifles?
You can't shoot deer at night, I argued, sounding frustrated. That would be illegal. You even get caught with a rifle at night, you'll get fined. I explained that we had spotted some deer bedded down in the meadows earlier in the day and were trying to find where they might be feeding so we could come back at daybreak and fill our tag. The guard eased up a little. I asked if he had seen any deer around. He told me that there were a lot of them out in the woods and that he had seen some big bucks. By now, he was relaxed, so we had a little conversation about hunting, exchanged some pleasantries, then said goodnight and walked away. When we had gone about 100 yards, John looked at me and said,
"How the fuck did you do that?"
Bounty hunting had taught me to think fast, but this meeting was not quite over. When I had shut off my night vision scope, I had stuck it in my jacket pocket, but apparently not all the way. It was no longer there and was too expensive to lose. I told John that I needed to go back and get it. We both felt we had just dodged a bullet, but I didn't want to leave without my night vision. John pleaded with me to forget it, but I was stubborn and turned round and yelled back in the direction of the guard that I had lost my scope and wondered if he had found it. The voice came back from the darkness.
"Does it look sort of like a flashlight?"
As John and I approached, the guard had the scope to his eye, trying to figure it out. I told him I was using it to try and track the deer and gave him a lesson on how it worked. He was so interested that he asked how much the scope cost and where he could get one. We talked a bit longer, then excused ourselves once again and left, this time for good. When we got back to the car, our nerves were still jangling. Then we laughed and the tension drained away. By mid-morning the next day, I was once again at the fence line. Krakauer had had to return home. After the previous night's experience with the guard, I wasn't all that eager to poke around out there alone, but I still had work to do. I was walking the perimeter of the property with my camera and video recorder when an all-terrain four-wheeler came grumbling through the trees. Opportunity or threat? The driver rolled to a stop and sat on the stuttering machine, staring at me.
"Hey," I called out, as cheerful as could be. "Come over here and talk to me."
He shook his head and stayed put on the John Deere machine.
"You'll start taking pictures of me," he countered.
"It's too late for that, pal," I said with a smile. I put my cameras on the ground and walked over to the fence some 20 yards away, hands empty.
"Come on. What? Are you afraid to talk?"
The slender man was not flustered by my goading.
"No, I'm not afraid to talk."
He wore a nice forest green jacket and a baseball cap. I could almost see his mind weighing the situation.
"Then what's the big deal? You're not going to get in any trouble, are you?" I tried needling him into action.
He turned off the engine, and quiet enveloped the area. "We had some intruders out here last night," he said.
"Really?"
I kept my face straight.
"Yeah.
We found some boot prints, and I was out looking around." He dismounted and walked over to the fence. Introductions were in order. "I'm Sam Brower."
"David Allred," he said, and we shook hands.
He said he had heard of me. By that time, a lot of FLDS people had the idea that I was the devil incarnate. I believe both Allred and I thought that we had each made a huge find and began fishing for information. The Moncos trip was not going to be a dry hole after all. He was cordial when he got to talking, telling me stories about the natural beauty of the area, with which I agreed. He said he had enjoyed the winter weather, which indicated that he had been at the Moncos hideout for at least part of the winter months. When he said that only his family was living there and he was doing some remodeling, I knew he was blowing a smokescreen.
You don't post guards at night for a little family get-together. And by this time, I had photographed the license plates of a number of cars in the area, some of which I would find were registered to FLDS members. It turned out that they had become pretty curious about me, too. Allred and I played each other for intelligence for a while, but I knew he was too sharp to tip me off that Warren might be there. Had he done so, I had a subpoena folded up in my jacket ready to hand over. Nevertheless, I had made a good contact, and I wanted to keep him on the line. I gave him my business card and said if he ever had any questions or wanted to know the truth about what was going on, just give me a call, and I would tell him whatever I was at liberty to discuss. That seemed to open him up a bit, and we agreed that it was a good idea to keep a back channel open, so he gave me his office number. It was a smart move on his part, because if I called, he might find out something useful. I had gone into Moncos to verify a hunch, and had come out on speaking terms with one of the top men in the FLDS. Sometimes you make your own luck. I would call Allred twice later during the investigation, and we chatted. But after that, he shut down contact.
R1 was discovered by our enemies,
Warren wrote soon after in the priesthood record.
A certain private investigator is searching for me.
I had come very close to my quarry. According to his journal, both the Prophet and Uncle Fred were at the Moncos compound when John and I were in the surrounding forest. The Prophet later claimed that he had been having weird dreams that
the devil himself was on the land.
My unexpected appearance at his place of refuge knocked Jeff's further off balance. He quickly started to move most of the Moncos residents down to Texas, whether or not they had yet been deemed worthy to go there. Chapter 22. Janetta.
I can't take it anymore. I have to get out.
The trembling voice of 17-year-old Janetta Jessup was a terrified whisper when she telephoned her older sister, Suzanne Jessup Johnson, on November 5, 2004.
Can you help me, please?
Suzanne had not seen or heard from Janetta for more than a year, ever since Suzanne had taken a plate of cookies over to the family home in Colorado City to congratulate Janetta on her 16th birthday. But the birthday girl had not been there. Neither had her belongings.
All of a sudden, it was like Janetta had never existed,
Suzanne told me later. There was open strife between Suzanne and her parents because she had abandoned the FLDS and did not recognize Warren Jeffs as a prophet. She was the only wife of Lester Johnson, who had also parted ways with Warren's madness and had become a follower of Winston Blackmore in Canada, although they both continued to live in Short Creek. Suzanne had asked her mother about Janetta's whereabouts and received only a stare and a bland,
"Well, I don't know."
After some prodding, her mother finally said that Janetta was on a special mission and was happy and well. For Suzanne, it was no real mystery. She just hoped what she suspected was not true. Two of her other sisters, Kate and Velvet, had been married to old Uncle Rulon and were among those wives later taken by Warren. Suzanne believed that pretty blonde Janetta also had become a new bride for the Prophet and was stashed away in some secret place against her will, struggling to make a run for it. I would later discover a photograph showing Warren Jeffs and Janetta, their arms entwined, drinking from silver goblets on their wedding day, after she had just turned 16. The surprise telephone call from Janetta on Friday, November 5th, made Suzanne afraid for her sister.
The first thing that crossed my mind was that Warren or somebody was doing something bad to her, or making her do things she didn't want to do, and it was scaring her.
Suzanne tried to calm her little sister and promised to help. Janetta quickly said she would pack some things and call right back to arrange a rendezvous. That was the last that Suzanne heard from her. The following day, their mother came to Suzanne's place in Hilldale to deliver a message.
I don't know what's going on, but Janetta told me to tell you. Never mind. Suzanne asked why her sister had not called her directly, and the mother shrugged.
Well, you know Uncle Warren has to be in hiding right now. It just has to be this way for a while.
Knowing that calling the Short Creek police would be a useless exercise and desperate to help Janetta, Suzanne and Lester instead phoned Winston Blackmore. He called me, and I felt a surge of adrenaline rushing through my veins. I was furious about this little girl being handed over to the prophet on her 16th birthday by her proud parents. That would make three of their daughters in the prophet's household. Quite a coup for Frank Jessup, as valuable as a truckload of gold in that cult. Janetta was in trouble, and we had to find her. The situation was the sort of opportunity for which I had been waiting. It is a felony in Utah for a man to marry an underage girl who is 10 or more years younger than himself. Warren was about 50 at the time, and Janetta, 16. If we could persuade her to tell authorities what had happened to her, confirm the sham marriage on the record, there would not only be civil matters pending and under investigation, but possible criminal charges too. Every cop in the land except those around Short Creek would be looking for Warren Jeffs. Taking it one step farther, if she would testify, it would also help focus some much-needed national attention on the plight of young girls in Short Creek. It could not have happened at a better time. I had some dependable law enforcement help. Riding in from the west, as the storybooks say, came Gary Ingalls, a no-nonsense, former homicide investigator hired by Mojave County, Arizona, specifically to monitor what was happening in Short Creek. Gary had been wounded in the line of duty. He was fearless. And he would never back down from any church goons. It would not be long before the entire town hated him as he dug in to the FLDS criminal organization. We would become close friends during the coming months, and we were happy to have each other as backup. Often, as we drove around Short Creek together, it seemed that we were the only two sane people on an otherwise screwball planet. In many such moments, we would adjourn to Gary's office, a double-wide modular trailer that had been set up on the edge of town on a rented rare piece of land that was not owned or controlled by the FLDS Church. We dubbed it Fort Apache, and it became our only sanctuary in an area where we felt surrounded by hostiles. We made a good pair, and, at the time, we were the only two investigators in the trenches actively working cases involving the FLDS. If a possible crime was involved, I always made Gary aware of it. Gary was still brand new to the job when Janetta Jessup telephoned her sister for help. The case was his baptism by fire, and he went after it hard, as was his style. Janetta's family lived on the Arizona side of Short Creek, within his jurisdiction, which gave him the authority to open an investigation. But Suzanne Johnson, who had received the distress call, lived on the Utah side. That invisible border had bedeviled real law enforcement for decades. The FLDS can run back and forth across it as they will, but a police officer with the wrong badge may end up hamstrung. Because of the jurisdictional mess, the first thing I advised Susie Johnson to do is file a missing persons report with the Washington County Sheriff's Office on the Utah side. They are the closest legitimate law enforcement agency, although Sheriff Kirk Smith was never pleased to have a Short Creek case dumped in his lap. A Washington County deputy was instructed to telephone Janetta's parents, who naturally said that she was safe and sound at home. That was case closed as far as the sheriff's office was concerned. I couldn't believe they would have made such a careless phone call, which tipped off the parents that the authorities were now looking for their daughter. That meant that any opportunity of finding her without alerting Warren had evaporated. Susie and Lester raised such a fuss about this that the sheriff agreed to send someone to verify whether Janetta was really at the house. A county detective knocked on the door of Frank Jessup. He had not been provided with a current photo of the girl for whom he was allegedly searching. The detective saw two girls wearing long dresses and the swept-up plig-do hairstyle. but neither showed identification, and the detective was not allowed to talk to them. When the parents assured him that one of the girls was the missing Janetta, the detective said,
"Okay,"
and left. The sheriff's office in Utah had done what it had to do, and no more. I was frustrated and concerned at the seeming apathy I was encountering in some of the law enforcement agencies. They had ignored Short Creek for so long, allowing the community itself to handle any problems within the little theocracy, that I felt they needed a push to start treating the Crick like the rest of the country. John Krakauer, untroubled by borders, stepped forward and wrote a detailed news release about the missing girl on November 12, 2004. It carried the bold-face headline, "Utah Sheriff Won't Investigate Call for Help from Underage Bride of Polygamist Leader Warren Jeffs." If the media picked up the story, the Utah Sheriff's Office might finally feel compelled to actively get involved. The news release worked. It led to appearances by Sheriff Kirk Smith and me on the nationally televised news show, Deborah Norville Live, where we discussed the case in separate interviews. Smith defended his department's actions in public. The undersheriff was so steamed about me pressuring them to do their job that he called me and threatened to arrest me for filing a false police report. That was ridiculous. The missing person report was not false, and I hadn't filed it. Susie Johnson had. Gary Ingalls also had been fuming about the inaction on the Utah side. He was not used to walking away from a challenge, and he made plans of his own to try to get a one-on-one with a girl, away from her parents. They lived on the Arizona side, which was his turf. He ignored the locals in Short Creek and launched his own investigation, bypassing the sheriff's office in Washington County. He arranged for some Arizona Child Protective Services workers to go to the house for a surprise visit, backed up by Arizona deputies. I followed with Suzanne in my car. A deputy knocked on the door, but there was no answer. We weren't surprised. My sources had warned me long ago that all FLDS residents in Short Creek had instructions from church leaders not to answer the knock of anyone who does not first call ahead. We were about to leave when Suzanne spotted her mother's car coming down the street, with Janetta in the passenger seat. When she saw that we were at the house, Mrs. Jessup kept driving right past the driveway. I pointed and yelled, "There they go!" The deputies pulled her over a short distance away as I drove up along with the CPS people. Janetta and Suzanne fell into a tearful embrace as their mother went into a tirade, shouting the automatic FLDS response about how government could not take away her child. The Short Creek police arrived and demanded to know why they had not been consulted. Gary responded in his usual professional manner, although I could tell he was tempted to laugh in the faces of the local cops for asking such an absurd question. Janetta was ferried to neutral territory at a Children's Justice Center in nearby St. George, Utah, for an interview. Our hopes for a big break now lay on the frail shoulders of young Janetta, who was overwhelmed by what was happening. The CPS worker spent 4 hours with her and determined that her shaky physical and mental states were in part due to large amounts of drugs, such as Xanax and Prozac. She appeared to be near to the point of incoherence. Janetta had spent time with some of Warren's other concubines at the R1 compound in Moncos, Colorado, where she had been moved after Warren took her into his fold on her 16th birthday. Once again, since it was not a legal marriage but an FLDS imitation, no laws had been broken. She was to complete her training there to become a heavenly comfort wife and learn the importance of keeping sacred things secret. She would get out of bed at 4 a.m, say her prayers, then feed the birds in the chicken coop. Such superficial descriptions of her daily life were a start, but not really helpful. She would not elaborate on where she had been for the past year, and would not discuss her relationship to Warren Jeffs. Once again, it appeared that the guilt and brainwashing that had been instilled in her, and her fear that she might be putting her salvation in jeopardy, stopped her from speaking out against the prophet. The family and the church got to her before we intervened. Janetta's most frequent answer, repeated over and over, was,
"I don't want to talk about it."
My hope of finding someone willing to come forth and tell the whole story of what had happened to her was dashed. But by this point in my investigation, I had learned not to expect much. Nothing was easy in dealing with an entire culture that was so completely dysfunctional. I had to be patient and thorough. Only later did I piece together what Warren claimed had happened to Janetta. In one of his heavenly sessions, recorded in his journal, Warren justified what he did by making the ridiculous assertion that evil powers had made Janetta tiptoe in the night to the room of Warren's own son, Mosiah, with a desire to have sex with him. According to Warren, Mosiah later confessed an attraction to her, so despite the fact that nothing had taken place between them and that Janetta had never even entered the room, they both complied with the prophet's insistence that they confess the sins of their hearts. Warren then banished them from R1 and sent Janetta further into hiding in Nevada. Putting together the interviews I had with her sister over time, plus the prophet's record, the story emerged that when the supposedly errant young wife got caught phoning her sister and planning to escape, and word came that police were involved, Janetta was sent back to her family in Short Creek to avoid further scrutiny by the law. Her father was given the responsibility of bringing her back under control so that she might one day again prove herself to be a worthy wife of the prophet. As disappointed as I was that Janetta would not talk, I was more surprised at the effect that her story had on me. It had very little shock value. Crimes had been committed against this young girl, and only a handful of people cared enough to even try to rescue her. It was maddening. But as the case had gone on, I found myself growing more matter-of-fact about the sick, hidden sins of Short Creek. The truth is that an investigator cannot survive and be effective if he walks around in a constant state of shock. You have to put the outrage aside and do your job. Poor Janetta was another young girl abused by the FLDS, one among so many. As usual, I would stay in touch with her sister in case something else developed. But I had to move on and think of the thousands of other children who still might be helped. Christmas does not exist in Short Creek. Warren had declared all holidays to be a distraction for the people, and proclaimed Christmas in particular to be evil and idolatrous. He weighed this as another chance to test how far the people would go in obeying his seemingly irrational commandments. There was little resistance about the ban on the Christmas holidays. With no bright lights or outdoor decorations, no toys, no trees with ornaments, and no joy, Short Creek seemed even more dreary than usual as 2004 wound to a close. That did not mean the fundamentalists were idle. Aerial photos of the ranch outside of El Dorado, Texas, had been gathering on my desk, and they showed the progression of a large new project down there. A wide, flat area had been cleared, and the latest photos showed that a huge foundation was being laid, with footings approximately 8 feet wide by 6 feet thick. Whatever was going in there would be enormous. Rumors were circulating that it was to be a temple. To most untrained observers, it was just another manifestation of Warren's eccentricities, but to me, it was evidence that Warren was taking his revelations of doom to the next level. Previous FLDS leaders had always been very vocal about not needing a temple, at least until the end of the world. I considered the sudden emergence of a temple to be significant and worrisome. Nothing happened over Christmas in 2004, but John Krakauer and I couldn't shake the eerie feeling that something was up. We devised a plan to split the New Year's duty and try to cover all of the bases. Gary Ingalls and I could keep an eye on Short Creek because we were invited to a New Year's Eve party there at the home of Marvin Wyler, the father of Ross Chatwin. Marvin also had been tossed out of the church, but, like a handful of others who had been excommunicated, he refused to leave Short Creek. John volunteered to travel to El Dorado and check out the Texas compound. The party was a rare opportunity for Gary and me to meet some more of the increasing number of FLDS refugees in a social setting, as opposed to formal interviews. No longer having to abide by the onerous rules laid down by Warren Jeffs, they could celebrate the holidays as they pleased. We were surprised to find that the gathering had grown into a large event, about 60 people, representing most of the excommunicated and isolated families in the area, dropped by Marvin's well-worn house on the Arizona side that night. Gary and I had grown accustomed to being vilified in this town, and it was pleasant to be able to just relax a little with people who knew that we were on their side. Presents were exchanged, and at midnight the kids shot off fireworks. Some people in Short Creek were actually having a good time. That scared the heck out of the cops. Police cars circled the house 17 times in the space of 1 hour, looking for a reason to stop the party. But no laws, not even their made-up kind, were being broken. Fireworks were not illegal in the state, and the streaks of sparks in the night and the firecracker pops made the house seem like a little oasis of merriment as the rest of the town hunkered down, dark and fearful. I was given a thick glass drinking mug decorated with ribbon and filled with homemade candy. We stood out as oddities, of course, but everyone wanted to shake our hands and ask what was going on with the legal side of things. They were curious about the missing prophet. Those at the party didn't know where he was either. John Krakauer awoke before dawn on the first day of 2005, and a short time later was strapped into the passenger seat of Jimmy Doyle's small airplane, flying out to the Texas site. As they approached, they saw activity down below at the ranch, but they were too high to make out details. As Doyle swooped the plane down for a closer look, Krakauer grabbed his camera and began snapping pictures. On the ground, panic ensued. People scattered, jumping into cars or heading for the tree line. A large black Suburban sped off. In moments, the place was clear, except for the big foundation footings that had drawn our attention in the first place. Later that same day, John downloaded the images onto his computer and studied the details. We had guessed right. The FLDS had picked a major holiday on which to dedicate the new foundation, betting that no curious outsiders would be around. They had gathered in a prayer circle, and in clear view, standing right in the middle, was a long, lanky figure, Warren Jeffs. It was Warren who had piled into the SUV at the approach of the aircraft. He later expressed his displeasure at being caught in the middle of the prayer circle and blamed the interruption on workers who had not removed some concrete forms and were thus responsible for delaying the dedication on the Lord's scheduled time. Warren noted that he had intended to depart the site by 6:30 a.m. John had caught him by only a few minutes. Uncle Fred, wheezing and on oxygen, was also there. It was a great way to start 2005. This was the first Warren sighting in many months, and it meant that he had not fled to Canada or Mexico as rumored. He was around, close enough to participate in activities at the compound. FLDS ranch spokesman Merrill Jessup had been lying when he had said that Warren never went there. In fact, according to the journal, once the plane had departed and the morning sky was again safe, Jeffs and his followers returned to the site and finished blessing the foundation before he sped off on his next road trip.
Chapter 23. Wicked. Heavy framework started going up at the Texas Temple site a few days after the hide-and-seek dedication ceremony. Only then did I start to get a feel for the size of the new building. As temple workers laid sheets of plywood for the first floor, I began making estimates of the size of the structure. It was going to be at least 17,000 square feet on each of three floors, and they were sparing no expense on the quality of building materials. Millions of dollars worth of mining, rock cutting, and construction equipment was brought in to extract the low-grade limestone from the ground. Under Warren's alternating whips of blessing and condemnation, construction went with lightning speed. Nobody can build faster than a troop of motivated FLDS builders who are convinced that they are working for their very lives and the profit. Jeff's journal would show that he constantly babbled directions, precise dimensions for a 30-foot-tall tapered tower to go atop the 3-story building, double insulation in the walls, darkly tinted windows. He had a mental vision for every inch of the building. But Warren was not one of those sweat-stained kids that the FLDS consigned to learn the building trades instead of going to school. He had none of their construction skills, nor did he possess the necessary architectural training. His design plan came through his fevered revelations, which meant some of it was impossible to carry out. That did not stop him from giving orders. When some irregularly shaped walls that he had dreamed up did not turn out as envisioned, he ordered Rulon Barlow, who was in charge of the framing, to double his crew and make it right. Barlow, an experienced hand, explained that they were in the middle of putting up windows, but Warren again firmly ordered him to fix the walls instead.
"I started helping them, carrying the sheeting that covers the outside of the wall,"
Jeffs would recall. He wanted to see to it that the job would get done. Then Barlow, holding his nail gun and standing next to Warren, made the terrible mistake of asking the prophet, "Will you get me my nails in that box right there?" Jeff stiffened, but handed him the few remaining nails. Rulon Barlow might have thought he could get away with such a liberty because the two men were related through the barter system. Barlow had gotten the prestigious foreman position among the temple builders at the ranch, while Warren had been given the Barlow's 13-year-old daughter as a bride. Within a year, she was pregnant. Therefore, Rulon Barlow was one of Warren's many fathers-in-law, although he was a decade younger than the prophet. Technically, he deserved some respect. He got just the opposite.
"I detected through the Spirit of God that this man delighted in directing me," Warren complained in his journal.
That night, Jeffs had a vision that Barlow no longer held priesthood and would have to be expelled from Short Creek, along with his family. Asking for a handful of nails had cost Rulon Barlow everything. Warren was laying plans for more than just routine construction. One of the last men the church had allowed to go off to be educated by outsiders had obtained a degree in electrical engineering before returning to the fold. He gradually was elevated into higher positions within the secret confederation of men and women found worthy of being temple builders. That required an oath of secrecy that read in part, "For and in behalf of the Lord and our prophet, I do willingly enter into this covenant with the Lord, to keep sacred things secret and not reveal what I hear in this training to anyone except by the prophet's immediate direction." He was instructed to build a high-tech thermostat that could take an incinerator up to an astonishing 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. As he worked, the engineer grew concerned about the ultimate use of the device, because that temperature was much higher than needed for almost any commercial application. He knew that even a crematorium operates at between 1,600 and 1,800 degrees to completely consume human bodies. When the leaders would not tell him the purpose, the engineer quit, and he was soon expelled from the church. Sheriff David Doran would eventually question Bishop Merrill Jessup about the superfurnace, and he was first told that it was to be used to make some gold fixtures for the temple. But the melting point of gold is just 1,900 degrees, so Jessup changed his story. They were developing a powder coating operation, although that could be done at about only 700 degrees. The third time around, Jessup said he was not sure why the powerful furnace had been built, but that probably it would just be used to burn trash. Although no one can say for certain, in my opinion, the existence of a high-tech, extreme-temperature furnace operation in the hands of a man with the mental and emotional instability of Warren Jeffs, who talked of blood atonement and made end-of-the-world proclamations, could be a dangerous thing. The idea of using it just to burn garbage seems ridiculous. I was unable to come up with a rational answer to the question of why Warren was secretly building such a futuristic piece of equipment. Was there some kind of evidence it could only be destroyed at very high temperatures? If so, what could it be? That Merrill Jessup could not come up with a plausible explanation bothered me. The question has never been satisfactorily answered.
What do we do about the Walter Steed case?
The prophet asked of his counselors in February 2005. Still another attack had come at them, this one launched in a complaint to the Utah Judicial Conduct Commission against Hilldale Justice Court's Judge Steed, by an anti-polygamous group known as Tapestry Against Polygamy. As implied by its name, Tapestry had been formed by a coming together of other groups to battle the polygamous lifestyle and help those wanting to escape. It operated independently, another example of how diffuse the overall effort against the FLDS remained. When I made a call to the commission to see what action might be taken about Judge Steed, who had steadily punished our clients with his own brand of heavy church justice, I learned that Tapestry was already in the process of filing a similar complaint. So we supported them, and I gave the commission a briefing on what our clients felt were some of the judge's abuses of power. With their automatic immunity from prosecution, judges are hard targets. But the stubborn Judge Steed was his own worst enemy. The part-time judge had been on the bench since 1980, hearing cases primarily on Saturdays so as not to interfere with his job as a truck driver. He was just another cog in the FLDS machine. Steed provided a legal shield for kicking young males out of town, or he would team up with the cops and frustrate the young men long enough that they would leave on their own. Some of our clients in the Lost Boys matter told of being picked up by the police on some absurd charge and taken directly before the judge, who sentenced them to perform community service without even being granted a hearing. Some boys literally had thousands of hours of community service stacked against them for charges such as being out past curfew or running away, the court's term for leaving the house without parental permission. Steed also provided revenue through court fines, such as traffic tickets on unsuspecting travelers. And he generally settled disputes however church leaders wanted. He belonged to them. Judge Steed was an unrepentant polygamist. So the easiest way to expose his unworthiness for the bench was not a stack of examples of bias and misconduct, but the underlining of how he had violated his oath of office. He had sworn to uphold the law, and polygamy was against the law. The judge was married to three women and had 32 children. Warren Jeffs certainly was not going to emerge from hiding to speak on his behalf. Answering his own question about what to do in the Steed case, Warren said,
"The Lord showed me through the night that I must answer them nothing, so I answer nothing."
Judge Steed was thrown under the bus. It took more than a year, but in 2006, the Utah Supreme Court finally kicked Walter Steed off the bench, ruling that his personal religious beliefs could not trump the law. In February 2005, the Lord told Jeffs to take another road trip, this time to the last place I would have suspected.
"He will have me witness one of the most immoral parties that this nation allows," he stated,
and with $10,000 in his pocket, he led his little cadre of Naomi and their driver helpers, Isaac Jeffs and Ben Johnson, to New Orleans. He had been there the previous year and witnessed the evils of a New Orleans Saints professional football game. This time, there was an even bigger attraction, Mardi Gras. They arrived in the Big Easy at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, February 6th, and Naomi and Warren were dropped off at Bourbon Street to stroll the French Quarter while Isaac and Ben hunted up hotel rooms. Soon, partiers were massing in what the prophet called
one great ugly dark immorality.
It was everything he had dreamed about. The parades began, and outrageously costumed and masked women and men aboard carnival floats pulled by little tractors hurled beads and necklaces into the cheering throng. Everyone seemed to be drinking. Girls were having their faces painted. Funny hats were everywhere. Wild music rolled out of bars. It was not yet 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the prophet and his team retreated to their hotel rooms about a mile from the action. Isaac and Ben were dispatched back into the party zone on a scouting mission. While Warren and Naomi rested, the two appalled elders reported by cell phone at 5 o'clock that things were getting wild. Men were hollering to women to bare their breasts in exchange for strands of beads, and the women were doing it. Ornate balconies around hotels in the quarter were thick with people flinging down beads and flashing their bodies while motioning for women to take off their clothes, too. The shocked FLDS men came back to the rooms so that Warren could join them for a nighttime foray after sending a message back to the faithful to pray for him because he was in great danger. He decided that he could not allow Naomi to witness the shocking goings-on, so he gave her a cell phone and ordered her to stay in the hotel room and push the sofa against the door. Naomi probably would not have been very pleased about being left out of the party. The woman was no fragile flower and was more than capable of taking care of herself. While most of his followers had not seen Warren Jeffs for more than a year, since August 10, 2003, Naomi had been constantly at his side as his most trusted and favored wife, friend, scribe, and lover.
"Howdy, Naomi's gorgeous,"
he happily declared to start one entry in his record. Gnomes was pretty in her long FLDS dresses with her flowing auburn hair wound up in a plig do, and she was even more delightful to Warren in the Gentile clothes that she wore on the road. One might think that she was really just another of Warren's many wives, a cowed adjunct to his massive ego. That would be a misconception. Anyone who challenged the queen bee would later regret it. Naomi was a player, and she had the prophet's ear. It seemed that she had been conniving her way to the top forever. As a daughter of Merrill Jessup, who was among the FLDS elite, she had been treated gently by others as a child and had quickly grown to understand the benefits of power. When she was only 11 years old, Naomi had created a sensation by kidnapping a girl of about 8 or 9 that she did not like and taking her down to the overgrown waterway from which the town of Short Creek drew its name, where she tormented her adversary and held her captive for an entire day. The whole town turned out to search for the missing girl, only to discover the perpetrator of the crime was off-limits to discipline. Instead of punishing her or getting her professional mental health treatment, the community hushed up the event and handled it in-house. Only 6 years later, on July 18, 1993, the 17-year-old Naomi had the honor of becoming a wife for the aging prophet Rulon Jeffs, who was 83 at the time. That catapulted her into an even more prominent role. The teenager matured into a shrewd young woman and became a favored wife of her elderly husband, although rumors swirled about her simultaneous closeness to his son, Warren. When Rulon died, Naomi quickly switched her allegiance and became Warren's first new transfer bride. She had no children by either of them, so there was no competition for her attention. Naomi got close to Warren and stayed there, a woman who knew all of the secrets of a religion run strictly by men. She appeared to be as adept at manipulating Warren as she had been in handling the old man, and by letting her transcribe the priesthood record, Jeffs gave her immense power. She was always at hand, or at least nearby, and in his description she heard the heavenly whisperings. She was very careful and knew exactly how the game was played. Warren might issue some vague warning, such as,
"The Lord is watching you closely, Naomi. Beware lest you fall."
That would spell doom for most FLDS members, but Naomi knew how to respond.
"I rejoice in you, sweetheart. I humbly acknowledge the error I am in questioning through a lack of reaching."
The problem was solved, the doubt crushed, and Warren's ego stroked. Her power lay not only in assembling his thoughts and sermons while he was awake, but in doing so even while he slept. Gnomes was the eternal sentinel, always there. And priesthood record sections frequently opened with the phrase, Naomi's testimony of what happened through the night.
She would spill forth some of the most dramatic scenes to be found in the thousands of pages of the record.
She would bear witness that Warren would fall unconscious and be surrounded by circles of flame, be thrown about and twisted on the bed, at times actually levitating above the mattress. Mysterious pillars of light would pulse at the bedside while heavenly bodies communed with the incoherent prophet. Naomi would claim that a veil would cover her eyes, and Warren would be gone from the room. She would hear soft voices as flames danced and the prophet would be returned to his bed, drained from visiting with heavenly beings. Even the prophet was impressed with what she said went on during his sleep. The revelations must all be true, because Gnomes was a singular witness, right there watching, listening, and writing it down night after night. She was the portal through which Warren was seen as a god, and he knew it. It was in his best interests to keep her happy, and so Naomi reaped the rewards of her transcriptions, be they fact or fiction. It was a win-win deal. Darkness amplified the hedonistic partying in New Orleans, almost overwhelming the three FLDS explorers as they shouldered through the drunken crowd.
Warren had led them all in prayer that they would not be sickened by what they were about to witness during this stern test by the Lord.
Women kissed and touched in the streets. They stripped in shops that painted their entire bodies. Male and female nude dancers shimmied in bars. Restaurants overflowed with business. Some couples danced crazily, with the women unzipping their partners and groping in public. People with cameras took pictures of every lewd act, and police wandered around almost aimlessly. Huge loudspeakers boomed deafening bass beats. Women fainted, drunks fell. As revolting as it was, God kept sending Warren and his two wide-eyed men back to be witnesses to the immorality of the world. As Warren watched it all, he appealed to God to destroy this wicked generation, he would recall. He leaned against a wall, raised his arms to the square, and delivered the revelers over to the judgments of God. When the three men eventually returned to the hotel, Naomi pulled the couch away from the door to let them in, and Warren got busy on the phones to set up the schedule for Sunday school back in Texas and Utah. After obeying the Lord's command to witness some more sinful behavior on the room's television set, they tried to get some sleep. Although a man and woman had a loud fight in the adjoining room at 4 o'clock in the morning. The Lord ordered Warren to stick around for another night so that he could actually witness more of the city's sins. When Hurricane Katrina struck the Louisiana coast 6 months later, on August 29th, devastating the city and leaving more than 1,800 people dead, the prophet was convinced that he had literally summoned down to this place of sin one of his oft-sought whirlwind judgments from God.
Chapter 24. Candy.
The chill of winter still gripped the high desert, and I was looking forward to taking some time off on a Saturday in April 2005, a foolish hope on my part. The phone rang, and Gary Engel's name flashed on the caller ID. I always answered his calls. If some FLDS zealots had flipped out and were after him, I was the closest reliable help. He would do the same for me. It was an unspoken agreement. "Hey, Sam, guess what?" Gary sounded excited, rare for him. "What?" "You remember that girl Candy, who was married to one of Joe Barlow's sons when she was 16? "Vaguely." "Kind of, why?" "Well, I got her phone number. She's living over in St. George. We should probably give her a call and see if she'll talk to us. Her sister seems to think she will. I guess she really hates the guy she was married off to, and she is pretty pissed at Warren for forcing her into it." We had heard so many of these stories that it was hard to keep track. "Who's the sister again?" "Tammy Shapley. She's Joe Holmes' girlfriend. Richard's nephew's girlfriend, said Gary. The names were tumbling into place, another strand of somebody related to somebody else, knowing still somebody else. Do you think we should give Candy a try? She probably won't talk, but you never know. I had learned to seize any opportunity when it came to the FLDS. Drag our feet, and a guilty conscience might kick in and prevent our potential lead from talking. Or the Warrenites might find out, and it could be over before it ever really began. Yeah, give her a call right now. If she agrees, I can be down there in 45 minutes. We had no way of knowing that we were on the verge of our biggest breakthrough yet. Gary and I had befriended an ex-FLDS businessman and former Colorado City councilman named Richard Holm, who hated the prophet so fiercely that he referred to Warren on national television as a dirty, rotten bastard, and would refer to the Jeff's compound in Short Creek as that brothel up the street. Warren had kicked him out of the church in 2003 and reassigned his family to Richard's own brother, Edson. After several months, Richard went to see his children, who no longer referred to him as father. They just called him Richard. The reassigned wife told him she was already pregnant with his brother's child. To say Holm was bitter would be an extreme understatement. We had recently attended a small party for FLDS refugees at Richard's house, where we had met one of his nephews and the young man's girlfriend, Tammy Shapley. The conversation had veered to the subject of Tammy's sister, Candy, who Tammy said had been forced to marry a real asshole at the age of 16. Candy had run away, but her brothers had been dispatched by her father to find her, and they brought her back. She eventually ran away again and made it out for good by finding a boyfriend and having sex with him. Once tainted by adultery, although there had been no legal wedding in the first place, she was considered sullied goods. Her FLDS husband no longer wanted her, and she was drummed out of the fold, never to return. She was another refugee who preferred to stay in the area rather than go out into the real world. When Tammy had told us that Candy might be willing to talk, Gary and I had exchanged glances. Was this a real lead or just another dead end? It deserved a try, however, and Tammy had soon forwarded the needed phone number through Richard. It worked. After our initial conversation, Gary phoned back to say the girl would see us. I hit the road from Cedar City to St. George and linked up with Gary. Less than an hour later, we pulled up in front of Candy Shapley's townhouse, feeling a push of anticipation. She answered the door herself. I found her to be a personable and pretty young woman, still only 19, with bright red hair and a little overweight from recently having had twins. She had a bit of fire in her eyes, still angry that no one had listened to her when she claimed she had been raped and brutalized by her FLDS husband. Within minutes, she was telling her story. She had waited a long time to be heard. Her tale could have been an FLDS primer. Candy grew up in a 20-bedroom, 16-bathroom home with her father, his six wives, and most of her 56 siblings. She was taught to keep sweet and prepare to be a good wife and bring children of her own upon the earth. Her trouble began when one of her sisters turned 17 and told their father she was ready to be turned in, the term for being placed with some worthy priesthood holder as a wife. Her father gave his approval, and an appointment was made for the girl to be interviewed by the prophet, who would choose a suitable candidate. Candy, who had just turned 16, went along to keep her sister company. Warren took it upon himself to add Candy to the list of brides-in-waiting. Soon, her father happily informed Candy that she would be married the very next day. He did not know anything about the groom other than he was a member of the large Barlow clan. Candy's life was catapulted in an instant from her comfortable day-to-day routine into a supersonic ride into the unknown. She had not seen this coming, and she was scared. Another friend and valuable resource would later fill in for me what happened next. Carolyn Jessup,
who eventually left the cult and ripped the lid off many FLDS secrets with her best-selling book, Escape, was managing the Caliente Hot Springs Motel in Nevada at the time. Her husband, the powerful FLDS functionary, Merrill Jessup, owned the motel on State Road 93, and it had become a favored hideout in which Warren Jess would perform multiple marriage ceremonies. Secrecy was paramount. No matter the age of the bride-to-be, crossing interstate boundaries for illegal sexual purposes is a serious crime covered by the federal Mann Act. Some underage brides were transported down from Canada, making it an international crime as well. The routine Carolyn described was very cloak and daggerish. The day or night before a set of marriages was to take place, she would receive a call to set aside a number of rooms, and the reservation would be confirmed the following day. The tip-off for Carolyn was if room 15 was among those to be reserved. Room 15 was a boxy little bungalow that sat alone near the office and was the place where the marriages were always performed. Each designated new bride would be assigned one of the other rooms and would stay inside with her family until it was her turn. Her groom, the priesthood holder, might wait outside in his truck. Then both would be summoned to room 15, which was decorated in pink, and the ceremony would be quickly conducted. The new couple would then usually drive off to their new lives while another couple would be called in for the next arranged marriage. Room 15 was a wedding assembly line for underage girls. That was exactly what faced the bewildered 16-year-old Candy Shapley. Candy told us that she was taken to room 15 and stood beside Randy Barlow and Randy's first wife, Valene, and his mother. Randy was 28 years old and had children by Valene, and although Candy had seen him around Short Creek, they had never spoken. Warren Jeffs performed the ceremony as Uncle Rulon Jeffs watched, and afterward, Uncle Rulon croaked out a blessing. I leaned back in my chair and quietly exhaled as she spoke, glancing over at Gary. This was huge. We were talking to someone who could personally testify that the prophet had married her off, knowing she was 16, to a man 12 years her senior. The fact that she had been shuttled to another state to avoid detection verified that a crime had probably been committed. Candy said that as they drove away from Caliente Hot Springs, she was apprehensive and confused. She did not even understand why she had to travel all the way to Nevada just to get married, although her father had told her there was a law against plural marriage in their home state of Utah. The real reason was that the Caliente Motel Marriage Factory drew no attention from outsiders. There were controls on who would attend, and it was a safe hideaway for the secretive prophet. Short Creek was too public. Her only comfort was that her father had also promised her she had the right to say no if she did not want to have sex with her new husband. Candy resisted for as long as she could, because anything to do with sex was entirely foreign to her. And when Randy finally made his move, she refused. The spurned husband bided his time and even met with Warren to complain that his young bride did not want to have children yet. The prophet instructed her husband to find a way. The next time, when she again resisted, she said Randy pinned her down and raped her. Later, she claimed he raped her again. Taking her problem to Warren did not help. The prophet told her the way to make things better was to become more obedient and have children. Feeling helpless, she submitted, but things only got worse. She would confide to me later that Randy was a brute who treated her like a slave and forced her to engage in group sex with him and another woman. By the time we left the initial meeting with Candy, we could see potential criminal charges all over the place, as well as a possible witness in our civil racketeering case. Candy's testimony would send both Warren Jeffs and Randy Barlow to prison. In this case, the wedding was a sham not only because Candy was underage and Randy was already married, but also because Warren, who performed the sexual arrangement, had no lawful authority to marry anyone. To be a witness in a sexual abuse case is difficult, and it takes a very brave woman to carry through to the end. But I headed home to Cedar City feeling optimistic.
I like candy. Maybe we finally had found someone ready to take it all the way. Maybe not. I rated it 50-50 at best. Fred Jessup, the genial Uncle Fred, had been missing for more than a year, ever since Warren had stripped